Chapter 41. Pedro had not yet returned from California. Hay fever and dark glasses did not improve G.A. Vronsky's appearance. Adorno, the star of Hate, brought his new wife, who turned out to have been one of the old and most beloved wives of another guest, a considerably more important comedian, who after supper bribed Bouteillon to simulate the arrival of a message necessitating his immediate departure. Grigory Akimovich went with him, having come with him in the same rented limousine, leaving Marina, Ada, Adorno, and his ironically sniffing Marianne at a card table. They played Biruch, a variety of whist, till a Lador taxi could be obtained, which was well after 1 a.m. In the meantime, Van changed back to shorts, cloaked himself in the tartan plaid, and retired to his bosquet, where the bergamask lamps had not been lit all that night, which had not proved as festive as Marina had expected. He climbed into his hammock and drowsily started reviewing such French-speaking domestics as could have slipped him that ominous, but according to Ada, meaningless note. The first obvious choice was hysterical and fantastic Blanche. Had there not been her timidity, her fear of being fired, he recalled a dreadful scene when she groveled, pleading for mercy at the feet of La Riviere, who accused her of stealing a bauble that eventually turned up in one of La Riviere's own shoes. The ruddy face of Bouteillon and his son's grin next appeared in the focus of Van's fancy, but presently he fell asleep and saw himself on a mountain smothered in snow, with people, trees, and a cow carried down by an avalanche. Something roused him from that state of evil torpor. At first he thought it was the chill of the dying night, then recognized the slight creak that had been a scream in his confused nightmare, and raising his head saw a dim light in between the shrubs where the door of the tool room was being pushed ajar from the inside. Ada had never once come there without their prudently planning every step of their infrequent nocturnal trysts. He scrambled out of his hammock and padded toward the lighted doorway. Before him stood the pale, wavering figure of Blanche. She presented an odd sight, bare-armed in her petticoat, one stocking gartered, the other down to her ankle. No slippers, armpits glistening with sweat, she was loosening her hair in a wretched simulacrum of seduction.
C'est ma dernière nuit au château, she said softly,
and rephrased it in her quaint English, elegiac and stilted as spoken only in obsolete novels.
"'Tis my last night with thee."
"'Your last night? With me? What do you mean?"
He considered her with the eerie uneasiness one feels when listening to the utterances of delirium or intoxication. But despite her demented look, Blanche was perfectly lucid. She had made up her mind a couple of days ago to leave Artists' Hall. She had just slipped her demission with a footnote on the young lady's conduct under the door of Madame. She would go in a few hours. She loved him. He was her folly and fever. She wished to spend a few secret moments with him. He entered the tool room and slowly closed the door. The slowness had its uncomfortable cause. She had placed her lantern on the rung of a ladder and was already gathering up and lifting her skimpy skirt. Compassion, courtesy, and some assistance on her part might have helped him to work up the urge which she took for granted, and whose total absence he carefully concealed under his tartan cloak. But quite aside from the fear of infection, Boot had hinted at some of the poor girl's troubles. A graver matter engrossed him. He diverted her bold hand and sat down on the bench beside her.
Was it she who had placed that note in his jacket?
It was. She had been unable to face departure if he was to remain fooled, deceived, betrayed. She added in naive brackets that she had been sure he always desired her. They could talk afterwards.
Je suis à toi. C'est bientôt l'aube.
Your dream has come true.
Parlez pour vous, answered Van. I am in no mood for lovemaking, And I will strangle you, I assure you, if you do not tell me the whole story in every detail at once.
She nodded, fear and adoration in her veiled eyes. When and how had it started?
Last August, she said, votre demoiselle picking flowers, he squiring her through the tall grass, a flute in his hand.
Who he? What flute?
Mais le musicien allemand, Monsieur Rock.
The eager informer had her own swain lying upon her on the other side of the hedge. How anybody could do it with Le Monde Monsieur Rock, who once forgot his waistcoat in a haystack, was beyond the informer's comprehension. Perhaps because he made songs for her? A very pretty one was once played at a big public ball at the Lador Casino. It went... Never mind how it went. Go on with the story.
Monsieur Rock, one starry night, in a boat on the river, was heard by the informer and two gallants in the willow bushes, recounting the melancholy tale of his childhood, of his years of hunger and music and loneliness, and his sweetheart wept and threw her head back, and he fed on her bare throat.
Il l'a mangé de baisers dégoûtants.
He must have had her not more than a dozen times. He was not as strong as another gentleman.
Oh, cut it out, said Vaughn.
And in winter the young lady learnt he was married and hated his cruel wife. And in April, when he began to give piano lessons to Lucette, the affair was resumed, but then...
That will do, he cried,
and, beating his brow with his fist, stumbled out into the sunlight. It was 5:45 on the wristwatch hanging from the net of the hammock. His feet were stone cold. He groped for his loafers and walked aimlessly for some time among the trees of the coppice where thrushes were singing so richly, with such sonorous force, such fluty fioriture, that one could not endure the agony of consciousness, the filth of life, the loss, the loss, the loss. Gradually, however, he regained a semblance of self-control by the magic method of not allowing the image of Ada to come anywhere near his awareness of himself. This created a vacuum into which rushed a multitude of trivial reflections, a pantomime of rational thought. He took a tepid shower in the poolside shed, doing everything with comic deliberation, very slowly and cautiously, lest he break the new, unknown, brittle Vaughn born a moment ago. He watched his thoughts revolve, dance, strut, clown a little. He found it delightful to imagine, for instance, that a cake of soap must be solid ambrosia to the ants swarming over it, and what a shock to be drowned in the midst of that orgy. The code, he reflected, did not allow to challenge a person who was not born a gentleman, but exceptions might be made for artists, pianists, flutists, and if a coward refused, you could make his gums bleed with repeated slaps, or still better, thrash him with a strong cane. Must not forget to choose one in the vestibule closet before leaving forever, forever. Great fun! He relished as something quite special the kind of one-legged jig a naked fellow performs when focusing on the shorts he tries to get into. He sauntered through a side gallery. He ascended the grand staircase. The house was empty and cool and smelled of carnations. Good morning and goodbye, little bedroom. Vaughn shaved. Vaughn pared his toenails. Vaughn dressed with exquisite care. Gray socks, silk shirt, gray tie, dark gray suit, newly pressed, shoes, ah yes, shoes, mustn't forget shoes, and without bothering to sort out the rest of his belongings, crammed a score of $20 gold coins into a chamois purse, distributed handkerchief, checkbook, passport, what else? Nothing else, over his rigid person, and pinned a note to the pillow asking to have his things packed and forwarded to his father's address. Son killed by avalanche. No hat found. Contraceptives donated to old guide's home. After the passage of about 8 decades, all this sounds very amusing and silly. But at the time, he was a dead man, going through the motions of an imagined dreamer. He bent down with a grunt, cursing his knee, to fix his skis in the driving snow on the brink of the slope, but the skis had vanished. The bindings were shoelaces, and the slope, a staircase. He walked down to the mews and told a young groom, who was almost as drowsy as he, that he wished to go to the railway station in a few minutes. The groom looked perplexed, and Vaughn swore at him. Wristwatch. He returned to the hammock where it was strapped to the netting. On his way back to the stables around the house, he happened to look up and saw a black-haired girl of 16 or so, in yellow slacks and a black bolero, standing on a third-floor balcony and signaling to him. She signaled telegraphically, with expansive linear gestures, indicating the cloudless sky. What a cloudless sky! The jacaranda summit in bloom, blue, bloom. And her own bare foot raised high and placed on the parapet, have only to put on my sandals. Vaughn, to his horror and shame, saw Vaughn wait for her to come down. She walked swiftly toward him across the iridescently glistening lawn.
Vaughn, she said, I must tell you my dream before I forget. You and I were high up in the Alps. Why on earth are you wearing town clothes?
Well, I'll tell you, drawled dreamy Vaughn. I'll tell you why. From a humble but reliable source, excuse my accent, I have just learned qu'on vous culbute behind every hedge. Where can I find your tumbler?
Nowhere, she answered quite calmly, ignoring or not even perceiving his rudeness, for she had always known that disaster would come today or tomorrow, a question of time or rather timing on the part of fate.
But he exists. He exists, muttered Vaughn, looking down at a rainbow web on the turf.
I suppose so, said the haughty child. However, he left yesterday for some Greek or Turkish port. Moreover, he was going to do everything to get killed, if that information helps. Now listen, listen. Those walks in the woods meant nothing. Wait, Vaughn, I was weak only twice when you had hurt him so hideously, or perhaps three times in all. Please, I can't explain in one gush, but eventually you will understand. Not everybody is as happy as we are. He's a poor, lost, clumsy boy. We are all doomed, but some are more doomed than others. He is nothing to me. I shall never see him again. He is nothing, I swear. He adores me to the point of insanity.
I think, said Vaughn, we've got hold of the wrong lover. I was asking about Herr Rock, who has such delectable gums and also adores you to the point of insanity. He turned, as they say, on his heel and walked toward the house. He could swear he did not look back, could not, by any optical chance or in any prism, have seen her physically as he walked away. And yet, with dreadful distinction, he retained forever a composite picture of her standing where he left her, the picture which penetrated him through an eye in the back of his head, through his vitreous spinal canal, and could never be lived down, never, consisted of a selection and blend of such random images and expressions of hers that had affected him with a pang of intolerable remorse at various moments in the past. Tiffs between them had been very rare, very brief, but there had been enough of them to make up the enduring mosaic. There was the time she stood with her back against a tree trunk, facing a traitor's doom. The time he had refused to show her some silly chose snapshots of punt girls, and had torn them up in fury, and she had looked away, knitting her brows and slitting her eyes at an invisible view in the window. Or that time she had hesitated, blinking, shaping a soundless word, suspecting him of a sudden revolt against her odd prudishness of speech, when he challenged her brusquely to find a rhyme to patio, and she was not quite sure if he had in mind a certain foul word, and if so, what was its correct pronunciation? And perhaps worst of all,
that time when she stood fiddling with a bunch of wildflowers, a gentle half-smile hanging back quite neutrally in her eyes, her lips pursed, her head making imprecise little movements as if punctuating with self-directed nods, secret decisions, and silent clauses in some sort of contract with herself, with him, with unknown parties hereinafter called comfortless, inutile, unjust, while he indulged in a brutal outburst triggered by her suggesting, quite sweetly and casually, as she might suggest walking a little way on the edge of a bog to see if a certain orchid was out, that they visit the late Krolik's grave in a churchyard by which they were passing, and he had suddenly started to shout, "You know I abhor churchyards. I despise, I denounce death. Dead bodies are burlesque. I refuse to stare at a stone under which a roly-poly old pole is rotting. Let him feed his maggots in peace. The entomologies of death leave me cold. I detest, I despise." He went on ranting that way for a couple of minutes and then literally fell at her feet, kissing her feet, imploring her pardon. And for a little while longer, she kept gazing at him pensively. Those were the fragments of the tessellation, and there were others, even more trivial. But in coming together, the harmless parts made a lethal entity, and the girl in yellow slacks and black jacket, standing with her hands behind her back, slightly rocking her shoulders, leaning her back now closer, now less closely against the tree trunk, and tossing her hair, a definite picture that he knew he had never seen in reality, remained within him more real than any actual memory. Marina, in kimono and curlers, stood surrounded by servants before the porch and was asking questions that nobody seemed to answer. Van said, "I'm not eloping with your maid, Marina. It's an optical illusion. Her reasons for leaving you do not concern me. There's a bit of business I had been putting off like a fool, but now must attend to before going to Paris."
"Ada is causing me a lot of worry," said Marina with a downcast frown and a Russian wobble of the cheeks. "Please come back as soon as you can. You have such a good influence upon her. Au revoir. I'm very cross with everybody."
Holding up her robe, she ascended the porch steps. The tame silver dragon on her back had an anteater's tongue, according to her eldest daughter, a scientist. What did poor mother know about P's and R's? Next to nothing. Van shook hands with the distressed old butler, thanked Boot for a silver-knobbed cane and a pair of gloves, nodded to the other servants, and walked toward the carriage and pair. Blanche, standing by in a long gray skirt and straw hat, with her cheap valise painted mahogany red and secured with a crisscrossing cord, looked exactly like a young lady setting out to teach school in a Wild West movie. She offered to sit on the box next to the Russian coachman, but he ushered her into the calèche. They passed undulating fields of wheat speckled with the confetti of poppies and bluets. She talked all the way about the young châtelaine and her two recent lovers in melodious, low tones, as if in a trance, as if en rapport with a dead minstrel's spirit. "Only the other day, from behind that row of thick firs, look there, to your right." But he did not look, sitting silent, both hands on the knob of his cane. "She and her sister Madeleine, with a bottle of wine between them, watched Monsieur le Comte courting the young lady on the moss, crushing her like a grunting bear, as he also had crushed, many times, Madeleine, who, said she, Blanche, should warn him, Vaughn, because she was a wee bit jealous. But she also said, for she had a good heart, better put it off until Malbrook, s'en va ton guerre, otherwise they would fight. He had been shooting a pistol at a scarecrow all morning, and that's why she waited so long. And it was in Madeleine's hand, not in hers. She rambled on and on until they reached Tourbière, two rows of cottages and a small black church with stained glass windows. Vaughn let her out. The youngest of the three sisters, a beautiful chestnut-curled little maiden with lewd eyes and bobbing breasts. Where had he seen her before? Recently, but where?
carried Blanche's valise and birdcage into a poor shack smothered in climbing roses, but for the rest, dismal beyond words. He kissed Centrion's shy hand and resumed his seat in the carriage, clearing his throat and plucking at his trousers before crossing his legs. Vain van Veen. The express does not stop at Torfyanka, does it, Trofim?
I'll take you 5 versts along the bog, said Trofim. The nearest is Voloskyanka.
His vulgar Russian word for maiden hair, a whistle stop, train probably crowded.
Maiden hair, idiot. Percy boy might have been buried by now. Maiden hair.
Thus named because of the huge spreading Chinese tree at the end of the platform, once vaguely confused with the Venus hair fern. She walked to the end of the platform in Tolstoy's novel, first exponent of the inner monologue, later explored by the French and the Irish.
Ne ver, ne ver, ne ver. L'arbre au courant et qui dort.
At least in the fall.
Never, never shall I hear again her botanical voice, fall at Biloba.
Sorry, my Latin is showing.
Ginkgo, ginkgo, ink, inkag.
Known also as Salisbury's Adiantifolia, Ada's infolio, poor Salisburya, sunk, poor stream of consciousness, Marais Noir by now. Who wants Ardis Hall?
Barian, a Barian,
said Trofim, turning his blonde bearded face to his passenger.
Da? Dajia skvoz kojene fatuk, nestalbia trogat etu, francuskuyu dzevku. Barin, master. Dajia skvoz kojene fatuk, even through a leathern apron. Nestalbia trogat. I would not think of touching etu, this, that. Francuskiu, French, adjective, accusative. Devku, wench. Ujas, ochayani, horror, despair. Jalost, pity. Konchenyo, zagajno, rasterzano. Finished, fouled, torn to shreds.